Hello, I'm Paul Vamvis, the host of Curiosity Never Retires. We're a podcast from Ollie at American University, an adult education organization that gives mostly, but not only, retired seniors a chance to study and teach topics they've been interested in for years. Ollie at American University teaches so many classes on so many subjects that we produce these podcasts to help you choose which ones you may be interested in. The range of subjects include politics, literature, music, history, languages, and many other topics. In this edition of Curiosity Never Retires, we're going to talk with one of our longtime study group leaders, Leonard King, about a course he is co-teaching with his wife, Betty, on the history of nonviolence. Welcome, Leonard.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Leonard, you are drawing from a wide range of sources for this course. You're calling it Nonviolent Resistance, Gandhi, King, Chavez, Tutu, and Now. So it may sound like an obvious question, but can you define nonviolence as a philosophy?
Definitely, but it is very complicated. There are a lot of misconceptions about nonviolence. Some people think, for instance, passive resistance is simply passive. It is not. It is active resistance to injustice. Martin Luther King said, "Violence is anything that denies human integrity and leads to hopelessness and helplessness." And therefore, nonviolence is the opposite. It is anything that upholds human integrity and leads to hope and empowerment. Nonviolence is not a last-minute act, but rather a never-ending process. Peace and nonviolence are based on the presence of connection and relationships, a shared humanness. Seeing the connections with others while respecting multiple differences from which we learn, and the right of all people to justice, freedom, and dignity. These perceptions lead to trust, community, coexistence, conflict resolution, forgiveness, and reconciliation. Ultimately, peace is about the quality of our relationships with others and with ourselves. It's about empathy, learning to think through the minds of others. Nonviolence focuses on the relationships created between the struggling parties. The problem is the problem, not the other person. Nonviolence creates win-win relationships rather than win-lose relationships. The work of active nonviolence is not just to avoid violence, but to add peace, to promote work, fun, love, learning, and self-expression rather than violence.
That is complicated. How did all of these practitioners in different times, in different places, come to the same common belief?
Well, first of all, the concept of nonviolence is very old. You might consider Adam and Eve's decision to eat the apple from the tree of knowledge as nonviolent resistance to authority. Certainly Moses' mother and Pharaoh's daughter's actions to save Moses was nonviolent resistance to tyrannical authority. At the base of most religions is nonviolent philosophy. For instance, they shall beat their swords into plowshare and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift sword against nation, neither shall they learn war no more. You could think about the Beatitudes of Christ. The United States has a long history of nonviolence. From William Penn and the Quakers, they called it the Holy Experiment, to Henry David Thoreau going to jail rather than paying taxes to support the Mexican-American War. There were conscientious objectors in every American war. The genius of Gandhi in India is that he developed what he called satyagraha, or soul force or adherence to truth, but he saw it as a group action for social and political change. The other examples I gave were very individual. It also helps to develop moral and spiritual growth in the individual. It's not just a protest, but an instrument of struggle for positive change. This change fueled the American Civil Rights Movement. For example, Bayard Rustin, James Lawson, and Martin Luther King Jr. studied Gandhi and all went to India. The philosophy and techniques developed in the civil rights movement fueled Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers Movement, the fight for women's rights and LGBTQ rights, and many other nonviolent movements, including the present nonviolent resistance to the Trump administration.
How did you come to be interested in this topic and study it?
I used to teach at the Murray School for 43 years. And when 9/11 occurred, I realized that the immediate response was to go to war. No one was asking why would anyone attack the United States. No one was trying to see the other side. And then I looked back and noticed in all my courses I have taught, I had some aspects of nonviolence. For instance, I taught Gandhi in an Asia and the West course. I taught about passive resistance and conscientious objection in my U.S. history courses. I taught about resistance to Hitler in nonviolent ways and rescuing Jews during the Holocaust in my 20th century Europe course. I even taught a section of a film class on anti-war films. And so I decided I would put together a course in the history and theory of nonviolence, which I taught for 11 years. And a lot of the students in the class went on to do good work seeking social justice, working environmental issues. So the last influence on me actually was my wife, who has taught me more about nonviolence than anything else. She is an amazing practitioner of it, and she has shown me that the peaceful resolution is the best kinds of resolution, especially if I listen to her.
Well, I think that's a lesson all husbands can take to heart. You mentioned Hitler's Germany, and you mentioned it in terms of the nonviolent help, particularly for rescuing Jews who were being murdered. But in another context, that same question, I think, always comes up in a discussion of nonviolence, which is, what do you do, what should you do when faced with a truly heinous evil that has no interest in negotiation or nonviolence, like Nazi Germany?
Well, we tend to see Nazi Germany as the representation of the epitome of evil. That is always the example used. But if we think about it, the way the British acted in India, not necessarily at home, but in India, Jim Crow and the Ku Klux Klan in the American South, apartheid in South Africa, the communist regimes in Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, and the Arab dictatorships in the Middle East, which was the target of the Arab Spring, were all violent, oppressive systems which were counteracted by nonviolent movements and which was successful. Also, nonviolence was used against the Nazis. Every individual, as you have mentioned, that protected and rescued Jews were practicing nonviolence. Oskar Schindler is the example that most people think of, but there were many, many others. In fact, I taught a course on moral courage and rescuers of the Holocaust. On a group level, there was a Rosencrantz prison demonstration in which German women who had been married, these were, quote, Aryan women, were married to Jews. Their husbands had been arrested, and some were even sent to Auschwitz. And what they did is they surrounded the prison, and they faced down machine guns, rifles, and in fact a tank. And they forced the Gestapo to release their husbands from prison. Some who had been sent to Auschwitz were returned. This was very successful, but it did not continue on different levels. There was another group called the White Rose, which was a group centered at universities who published anti-Nazi newsletters. The French village of La Chambon became a refuge for Jews, and the entire country of Denmark nonviolently resisted the Nazis and saved almost all their Jews by ferrying them to Sweden. About nonviolent resistance to the Nazis, B.H. Lindell Hart wrote, "The Nazis had an ability to cope with it. They were experts in violence. They had been trained to deal with opponents who used that method, but other forms of resistance baffled them. It was a relief when the resistance became violent because the Nazis knew how to deal with it." And there are other examples of nonviolence that were in Nazi Germany.
I think we can all personally think of examples of the effect of violence on people. But what is the transformational effect of dealing in nonviolence on the people who take up that cause?
Nonviolence is, you use the term transformative, and I would agree totally. Mm-hmm. It makes you a more peaceful person. It gets you to look at the world differently. It gets you to look at relationships in terms of finding common ground. It gets you to realize that there's a great deal of good in people, not just the worst part of them, and that the struggle for peace and justice is going to transform you into becoming a better person. If you look at the examples, for instance, just recently of the No Kings demonstrations and how people felt being in a group who were all working for the same common peaceful cause, it makes people feel very good. Let me give you some historical examples, at least two of them. One is in 1992, Michael and Julie Weiser, who were Jewish, were being harassed by Larry Trapp, who was the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. He would call them up, say awful things to them, threaten their lives, etc. The way the Weisers reacted is they offered to give him rides to the grocery store. They bought him dinners. They realized he was in a wheelchair and found out that he was in a wheelchair because he had been severely beaten by a black gang. They applied compassion and courage in the face of Trapp's racism. Eventually, what happened was that Larry Trapp gave the Weisers his Ku Klux Klan ring, signifying that he was quitting the movement. That's pretty amazing.
That is pretty amazing.
Lots of examples in the civil rights movement, but let me give you one other example that I use about forgiveness. Azim Khamisi's son, Tariq, was a college sophomore who was earning extra money by delivering pizzas. And when he delivered pizzas to a group of African-American kids, he was shot by one of them, a 14-year-old boy named Tony Hicks. They were high on drugs. Azim came to the realization that it was the gun and the social forces that surrounded them which made both Tariq and Tony victims of the system. Azim met Tony's grandfather, Ples Felix, who was raising Tony, and they not only became friends, but started the Tariq Khamisi Foundation to help create safer schools and communities and prevent teens from turning to crime. It was a way to honor his son's legacy and to give his short life more meaning. For the past 28 years, Azim and Ples visited schools and prisons together. When Tony got out of prison, he joined them. Azim said, "I do believe that we are all at some point have to learn to forgive. If we have enough people forgiving, that would shift society."
Leonard, it sounds like a fascinating class, and it couldn't be more timely.
Thank you very much.
Curiosity Never Retires is produced by myself, David Flaxman, Andrew Hiller, and Jesse Williams. Our theme music is education music from Background Music for Video by Pixabay. Please listen to other episodes of this podcast to learn more about what Ollie at American University is offering. For Curiosity Never Retires, I'm Paul Vanvis. Stay curious.